welcome to another episode of Bowel Sounds, the Pediatric GI Podcast, the official podcast of the North American Society of Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition, or NASPGHAN. I'm Jason Silverman, and I've got the great pleasure of being joined by Dr. Jennifer Lee today. How are you doing, Jen?
Hi, doing great. Good to see you, Jason.
Now, so this episode is coming out kind of late August. You know, lots of kids already back at school, depending on where you're listening to this. Some kids, you know, about to head back to school. But, you know, we've gone through the summer of, probably if you have kids, summer of dealing with camps. Now, I don't know about your kids, Jen, but my kids need to get kept busy during the summer. So it's pretty much chock-a-block with day camps throughout the year. They have a bunch of programs that have been arranged. They actually have university camps. So no, they're not like practicing being university students. It's that the university that I work at, the University of Alberta, actually hosts summer camps for kids. And they have a variety of athletic programs, some STEM programs. So kids get to do like computer stuff or chemistry camp or whatever the case may be. And it's actually hosted in university buildings. So the swim camp gets to use, you know, Olympic-sized pools and cool things like that. And this year, my oldest actually got to go to overnight camp for the very first time, which was kind of a big deal for him. Do you have any memories of either camps for your kids or camps for you growing up?
So, no. I grew up in rural West Virginia, and my mom did not work in the summer. So we basically just ran around everywhere. But did you see there was a news article the other week in Bloomberg Businessweek about how summer camp has kind of gotten out of control in the last few years?
I have not.
Yeah, you know, it talks about how there's a lot of dual working families and, you know, there's no school in the summer. Mm-hmm. And so now there's this whole, like, need for summer camps, and there's summer camps for everything, and the cost has gone up, and it's becoming like a little bit ridiculous. Now, we're lucky. My kids have a summer camp right up the road. They go Monday through Friday because my husband and I are both physicians. So our schedules are quite busy, and they go to the pool. It's more of a relaxing summer camp, like go to the pool, they have activities and lunch and whatever. But yeah, no camp for me though. How about yourself?
My mom wasn't working for a big chunk of my childhood, or I should say she did work. She did a lot of hard work, but she worked from the home.
Yeah. Same.
And so we didn't sort of, quote unquote, need to be out of the house, didn't need to go to camp, but we did go select weeks to some sports and activity camps. Like I think I did tennis camp one year and just sort of general outdoorsmanship kind of camping. I did go to overnight camp just one year. I went to overnight camp for 1 month, 1 year, and it was a bit of an experience. But I like the day camps, sleeping in my own bed. So,
yeah. Well, and I think for anyone who's listening, at least for me, I think that the childcare situation when you have dual working household can sometimes be challenging as far as, you know, what are we going to do when the kids are at work? And so the other thing that was in the article is a lot of the sport camps that you're mentioning are just for part of the day. Mm-hmm. So like it's 3 hours Monday through Friday, which is not always conducive to a two full-time working household. And so, yeah, it's a really challenging thing I think a lot of us face in the summer.
Absolutely. And if only we had the flexibility of bring your kid along to work day. It's okay. You just hang out over there, do your stuff, read your book. We're all good.
Maybe one day. Well, today we're talking about another episode. It's kind of like a transition, right? You transition from summer to school and camp. And today we're actually talking about another transition in healthcare, which is for patients with liver transplant, transition from pediatric liver transplant center to an adult center.
That's right. And this is another one of our sort of special JPGN associated episodes. And we're covering the position paper, the healthcare transition for adolescents and young adults with pediatric onset liver disease and transplantation. And we have The really good fortune of talking to the first author on this paper, Dr. Jennifer Vittorio. And Dr. Vittorio is an associate professor of pediatrics in the Division of Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition at the NYU Grossman School of Medicine. And she's an attending pediatrician at Hasselfields Children's Hospital at NYU Langone Health. And she was recently recruited to NYU to serve as the medical director of their brand new pediatric liver disease and transplant program. So really lucky to have her join us on the show. And it was a great conversation and we can't wait to share it with you guys. On to the show.
No. On to the show. Aww. I was muted.
Dr. Vittorio, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me here. This is a true privilege, I think.
Well, it's great for us to have you on another special JPGN crossover episode where we're going through a position paper from the journal. But before we get into our topic today, we're going
to
start.
Wait a second. Oh. I have to break in. This is like the first double gen episode. So we've got two gens on the line today.
It's true. I feel left out. So for the rest of this episode, you guys can call me Jen too. I don't know.
Okay, we'll do that. Just to confuse things.
Yeah, just another level of confusion here.
Exactly. All right. So we're going to start with a question that our guests might find the most challenging. But for our listeners that don't know you, how would you describe yourself in one sentence?
So I would say that I am a native New Yorker. I'm a transplant hepatologist with an interest in healthcare transition. And for those who may not know, I was recently recruited along with an amazing team down to NYU Langone to start their inaugural pediatric liver transplant program.
Very cool. That's going to play into a lot of our conversation today, but that's fantastic.
So second question, and this one's near and dear to my heart because in a few months, I'm actually going to New York City for the very first time in years. So you're in New York City and it's huge. I mean, there's so much to do, right? Broadway and Central Park. But if you had to give me and our listeners any recommendations for just things you cannot miss that the average tourist might, what would you recommend?
Well, Jen, I think you could very easily turn this into an entire podcast in and of itself, right? So there's so much that I love and want to share about New York City. But for me, you know, I think it really depends on the season. You know, it's almost like the city turns into a different place depending on what the weather holds and what time of year it is. One habit that I picked up sometime, you know, probably around the time of the pandemic was biking. And so there's something that I started doing a few years ago called Bike New York, which is a bike trip through the five boroughs where they close down the streets. It's a nice way to sort of see the city. Happens once a year. So if you want to put that, you know, on your calendar for next year, it's usually the beginning of May. And it kind of ends in like a nice party, like out in Staten Island, where you can kind of enjoy the company of those you've just been, you know, hiking up the bridges with. You know, as we get into the summer months, I think sometimes people are almost encouraged to leave the concrete jungle and head out to some of the local beaches. I grew up in Long Island, so I'm a little bit partial to the South Shore. And then in the fall, of course, you've got Central Park, the change in the leaves. It's just nice to be outdoors. If you are a sports fan, I think that New York will not disappoint. I have season tickets to the New York Giants, and so that's always a fun way to spend a weekend. Soccer is another passion of mine. And then, you know, certainly the New York City Marathon is unbelievable. So the energy that comes along with that, I have I've been fortunate the last few years. I actually live right next to the finish line in the park. And so it's just this whole area sort of shuts down and it becomes an incredible celebration, you know, of family, friends and whatnot. So it's just something I think you've got to get on your calendar at some point or another to experience. And then, you know, certainly in the winter, you've got the holiday season, plenty of window shopping, go out to Rockefeller Center, see the tree, catch a show at Lincoln Center, Radio City. So I think no matter what you're looking for, you'll find something to do.
We could talk about New York City, like you said, all of the next hour, but we have a big topic to get into.
So today we are covering the recent NASPGHAN position paper on healthcare transition for adolescents and young adults with pediatric onset liver disease and transplantation. This is a huge and incredibly important topic. But before we start really diving into it, I really want to talk a little bit about terminology. You know, we were discussing before we started our recording that sometimes these words transfer and transition are often used interchangeably. Can you kind of set the record straight here? What should we be using and what should we use for the rest of the podcast?
Yeah, thanks, Jen. That's a great point, because I think often those two terms are confused, and I think they both have, you know, special meaning. So I think what I wanted to sort of point out is that healthcare transition, so that transition part, is actually like a process, right? So we're talking about, you know, moving from a pediatric to sort of more of an adult model of care, you know, and that may happen with or without a change in provider. So that change in provider or the location where care is being delivered, that's what we refer to as transfer. So, you know, really the point that I want to sort of highlight is that transition of care doesn't end when that transfer of care happens, right? But it's really this process that needs to continue even into young adulthood.
I think that's so important, especially because in chronic liver disease and pediatric transplantation, sometimes these children had their transplants when they were babies. Mm-hmm. And so there's that interaction between the parents kind of assuming the guardianship and making most of the decisions for most of this child's life potentially. And so I think there's a lot of complex factors that play in here. So I love that, that transition continues even after transfer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we're going to get into more details about that, but I think it is a really important part that's emphasized really well in this paper. Speaking about the paper itself, obviously position papers are usually written to fill a need. So what was the impetus to get this position paper out there? You know, there's a lot of literature on transition in various different chronic disease conditions or chronic health conditions, but what was missing from the transplant literature before this paper?
So I think if we're going to talk about the motivation for the position paper, you know, one thing that may be helpful as background is to sort of talk about where my interest in healthcare transition started from. So when I became a new faculty member, I had inherited, you know, a panel of patients. And there's one patient that really stands out in particular. This was a young adult, probably around 20 or so years of age, who I think was really struggling with several aspects of her life and, you know, wasn't really able to sort of focus on her transplant needs and, you know, her chronic condition. She had very little support at home. She was struggling to sort of make ends meet, paying rent. We could not reach her. Oftentimes, phone numbers got disconnected, emails turned off, and then, you know, we'd really only see her when she would show up in the emergency room. So, you know, of course, fast forward, she ended up developing chronic rejection in the setting of non-adherence and, you know, ultimately indications for retransplantation. Due to her history of non-adherence, she was actually denied transplant at several centers. And ultimately, she ended up passing away shortly after she was transferred to our adult colleagues. And so that, you know, really, I think, kind of inspired me to sort of sit down and investigate what was happening with a lot of these patients, you know, after they were transferring from our pediatric team to our adult team. And I know this patient, you know, isn't something unique to my experience. We've all, you know, I'm sure, thinking about similar patients and the struggles that come along in caring for them. So I sat down and I took a look at the patients that have been transplanted in pediatrics and, you know, we had transferred over to our adult colleagues. And what I found was that shortly after that transfer, patients were, you know, experiencing worse health outcomes. They had elevations in their LFTs, more episodes of chronic rejection. Measures of adherence seemed to be worse with increased standard deviation in some of their immunosuppressant levels. Healthcare costs and utilization were rising. And so, you know, none of that was good. But I think the most disturbing part for me was that, you know, nearly 30% of our patients, sometime after they transferred to our adult team, had passed away. And, you know, that's about a third of the patients. And when we really sat to take a closer look to see if we could identify some prognostic factors as to why this was happening, we found that those patients who had passed, you know, had underlying psychological illness and substance abuse when compared to those who survived. And so we just thought, you know, there's got to be a way to do better and to kind of help support these patients during this like vulnerable time period. And so that was sort of the motivation for starting our healthcare transition program. And then when I was a member of the NASPGHAN Hepatology Committee, we found that obviously this was something that people were really struggling with across the board. That, you know, there's a lot of literature out there which unfortunately does recognize and has similar findings to our study, you know, with the high mortality, morbidity rates in this population. And there's even been, you know, a lot of discussion surrounding barriers to successful healthcare transition. But despite these inherent risks, there really was no like formal or standardized transition process that had been put forth for patients with chronic liver disease and transplantation. And so we thought what was missing was sort of like a how-to, right? A how-to create a successful transition program and something that really spanned across both pediatric and adult hepatology transplant centers.
Yeah, that certainly takes a lot of coordination. And it's kind of incredible that you took that one experience and you've really built this career on that. I'd like to expand on the barriers just a little bit. That's something you really talk about at the beginning of the paper. So what types of barriers did you find? And can you just kind of walk us through what you found and what we can do about it?
Sure. So the first part of that question may be a little bit easier. What did we find than what to do, right? Like that's where the money's at. But so I think, you know, the barriers to transition, right, are definitely multifaceted. And they can occur at the individual level, the family level, and certainly system-wide. So if we start and we focus a little bit on this particular patient population, adolescents and young adults, I do think there are some unique developmental aspects that, you know, not everyone may be aware of in this particular age group. So, you know, for instance, we know that executive function, right, is very important in terms of making rational sort of, so to speak, decisions. But what people may not recognize is that executive function, right, is something that probably doesn't complete or fully mature until your late 20s. So we're dealing with a group of individuals who have this rapid development of the limbic system, right, which is really responsible for reward-seeking behaviors and emotion. And then you've got this slower maturation of your prefrontal cortex, which is the part that's responsible for like planning and impulse control, organization, right? So we have a group of young adults who really choose actions that maximize short-term rewards over long-term outcomes. So, you know, if you've got someone that you're trying to emphasize the importance of taking your transplant medications and they feel okay, they may not necessarily recognize the importance of that immediately. It's a little bit easier to, you know, tell people to take medications when they don't feel well and, you know, they're motivated in other ways. In the adolescent and young adult population, we know that there's an increased incidence of psychological illness like depression, anxiety. There have been increased incidence of PTSD in the solid organ transplant population. And so when you think about, you know, these things that are inherent to that particular age group, and then you add the addition of a chronic illness, right? I mean, that can really be overwhelming for many folks. And now you're also in a time period where caregivers are starting to take a step back. So it makes sense that, you know, there are going to be lapses in adherence. And like, we've really got to do our best to sort of step up, recognize the population that we're dealing with and find a way to support them through this time. They'll get there, right? It takes a little bit of an extra effort on our part in order to help them appreciate what we're talking about and maybe what some of those long-term implications can be. You know, I think in terms of it, and I don't want to focus and say that it's all the patient's fault. That is certainly not, you know, the message that I'm trying to convey. I think pediatric providers as well, I think we often struggle with relinquishing care to some of our adult colleagues. Many times we've met these families, you know, these patients when they were just a few weeks old, maybe a few months old. We've seen them through some rough beginnings. We've talked them through, you know, transplantation in many instances. And there's sort of this idea that no one can do things as well as me, right? They're not going to understand or appreciate what this family went through. We also engage in a lot of handholding behaviors, right? Oh, it's okay that you showed up a few hours late. I'll see you anyway. And at the same time, we start saying things like, you know, but they're not going to tolerate this on the adult side. You know, this isn't going to fly. They won't see you. I mean, if we start to make statements like that, why would anyone associate, you know, transferring over to the adult team as a positive thing, right? And then I think we've really got to do and become more aware of the need to begin the transition process early on, right? We've got to start screening for transition readiness. We've got to start, you know, looking for mental health concerns and plugging these patients in with the appropriate support. So that's really something the pediatric team needs to work on. And then our adult providers, I think that, you know, since there have been many advances in both medicine and surgical techniques, we're finding children, patients with childhood congenital diseases are living longer and longer, and there's this need to transfer them, right? But now we have, you know, adult providers who may not be as familiar with some of those underlying diagnoses. They don't receive any formal training in adolescent medicine, right? And may not be aware of some of the developmental concerns. And then on top of that, you know, you've got much higher volumes, busier practices, right, where you have a lot of time constraints that really limit your ability to spend the necessary time with these patients and support them through a lot of the things that we're talking about. And then, you know, finally, there's the healthcare system itself. There is absolutely an inadequate health insurance and transition services funding. We're going to talk a little bit about today that, you know, transition is a labor and resource intensive undertaking. And oftentimes, I think priority is placed on earning those RVUs and reimbursement rather than, you know, people aren't rewarded for the amount of time that they spend with the patients. And it's all about who can bill for this visit and whatnot. So I think those are things that we can really do a better job with.
So first of all, for anyone who hasn't taken a look at the paper, check out Table 1, because I thought that was a really interesting and a nice way to approach this, because our children are living longer and longer. And are, like you mentioned, the adult providers may not have had that same training that we did in some of these specific conditions. And so I really, really love that table. The other question that I have that kind of I noticed in the barriers, but you didn't expand upon a lot, was that part about the school or vocation. So when I think about myself at age 18 or 20, wanting to go to college, do you find that that's a barrier if children are wanting to move away from their home? Or how do you typically recommend that or navigate that scenario?
Yeah, so I think, you know, that's something that comes along with transition planning. So we're going to talk about how, you know, we go about initiating transition, what that process looks like. But I think that has to sort of be incorporated with what does that plan look like? It's very attractive to want to stay, I think, sometimes at the institution. You know, in some instances, you may have a pediatric transplant center that has an affiliated adult transplant center. And that, you know, that transfer may be a little bit easier. But when you have patients that are telling you, hey, I have aspirations, you know, I'm from New York, I have aspirations to go to college in California, we've got to go about working together. Well, what does that look like? We need to find you a local team. And if we can do this early enough, we can make that happen appropriately and not like me getting a call in the middle of the night. Hey, I'm across the country. I'm not doing very well right now. Help, ending up referring them to the, you know, local ED that may or may not of a transplant team with some caregivers that don't know them. So that can be a little overwhelming and anxiety provoking for sure. But I think that vocation, the ability to or the idea to want to graduate high school, to want to have a job, to be like forward thinking like that is so important and something that we have to discuss with our patients.
That's great.
So any patient or family that's listening, that's an important part of the conversation too. So make sure you bring that up as well. Sorry, go ahead, Jason.
No, it's okay. I really like that breakdown of thinking about the individual, thinking about the family, thinking about the system level. I have to say, when you were talking about the adolescent and young adult, the executive functioning, as a father of two young boys, I see that live every single day. You know, the most common question asked in our house is, why did you think that was a good idea? And so I'm a little bit depressed, you know, being reminded that it might be, you know, a long, long time before that improves, but it is a really important part to remember. So when we talk about the transition process, you know, the recommended approach that is summarized in the paper is based on the six core elements of healthcare transition, which is advocated by the AAP, AAFP, ACP, Clinical Report on Healthcare Transition. So that's a mouthful. What are these six elements of transition and why is each so important in the transition process?
So for starters, for those listeners that are not familiar with a group called Got Transition, I would very much encourage everyone to go to gottransition.org. This is a fantastic website. Mm-hmm. Got Transition is a federally funded National Resource Center on Healthcare Transition. And this was an organization that I think began as like a cooperative agreement between the Maternal and Child Health Bureau and the National Alliance to Advance Adolescent Health. And they were the ones that sort of put together and develop these six core elements of transition. And what I really like about this, and we'll go through a little bit, is that it really incorporates all three phases of transition support. So the preparation, the transfer, and then integration into adult healthcare are all included in there. And there's a bunch of sample set of tools for, you know, pediatric adult providers, and even patients and families. So it's quite helpful and definitely a good resource. So what they sort of advocate with starting with is the first element of transition is to create a transition policy. And this is something that I found incredibly helpful. And like I said, there are sample tools on there that you can, you know, adapt from. But this really describes your individual program's approach to transition that you can share very early on in the process with families and adolescents. Some people have even advocated including this as part of our transplant evaluation, you know, which seems maybe a little silly in when you're evaluating like a 6-month-old perhaps, but just, you know, to kind of give people an idea that it's out there. You know, to talk about like privacy and consent issues that change, you know, when patients turn 18 years of age. And it should also, you know, touch upon when do we start the transition process. For our program, it's around the age of 12. And then what is the anticipated timeframe that we're looking at in order to transfer over to an adult team? And obviously, this is going to really vary by institution. You know, what we try and aim for is sometime around 21 or 22. The second core element sort of talks about tracking and monitoring. Now, I will say with the liver transplant population, right, we obviously have very close records and documentation of who all of our transplant patients are. If you're talking about finding non-transplant patients, autoimmune, biliary atresia, right, maybe a little bit more challenging to put together a list of those patients that you want to capture. And so billing codes or things like that can often be utilized within the EHR. But I do find it helpful to create a list of these patients, to create a flow sheet, right, so you can track the different core elements and the progress that individuals are making. I think that's so helpful. And even after, you know, they move on to the adult side, I think it's good for the adult team to also have a way to track these individuals, right? We already talked about the fact that they are a very vulnerable population. They have an inherently increased risk, right? And so we want to keep a close eye on them. I think the bulk, so the core element number three talks about transition readiness. And again, you know, I advocate really starting early. I know there are some folks that will start as early as age 10 or 12, but transition is a process we're used to in pediatrics, right? It's all about preventative medicine. So I'd say that sort of falls into this category. We've got to start introducing these concepts early. The website Got Transition, again, very helpful and has a number of transition readiness assessment tools that have been validated in all sorts of populations with chronic illness that can be easily utilized in your practice. And it's kind of a way to kind of get a sense of where your patients are, what is their understanding of their underlying disease. I like to use these too with the caretakers present, because I think sometimes it's really funny to watch when I, you know, ask a child, tell me your medications, and you either get one of two responses from the parent, right? The child, you know, flawlessly lists their medications and the parent looks over in shock, like, I didn't know you knew that. Or they struggle. And the parents looking over at them like, come on, you know this, right? Don't you? But so I think it's kind of like eye-opening for all of us to really see where they're at. And then I use these, you know, to kind of, during each of our transition visits, we try and set goals, right? So if it's, again, starting with a 10 or a 12-year-old, sometimes it's just learning the name of their underlying illness. Sometimes it's learning the name of their medications. You know, once they accomplish that, then we can move on to other things. Like, do you know how to call for an office visit? Do you know what happens when you need a medication refill? So you really have to make sure that you're doing this in a developmentally appropriate manner. The fourth element that we move on to is, you know, this transition planning, which we were, you know, kind of alluding to a little bit earlier, right? So I think that we would be doing a disservice to our patients if we waited for their, say, 18th birthday and said, okay, well, we got to find you an adult doctor now. So how are you going to go about doing that, right? I think it's much more meaningful if we introduce this concept early, so we're all on the same page. And we can take into account things like, do they plan to relocate? Maybe they don't live near their pediatric transplant center. You know, remember, there are certainly more adult transplant centers that exist. Sometimes we've got to get creative, and it's not a matter of, they might want to continue at our center with our adult team, but sometimes they travel, you know, almost 8, 10, 12 hours distance in order to make office visit appointments. And so maybe we have to find them an adult gastroenterologist that might have some comfort in dealing with, you know, transition patients and transplant patients. And so those are all conversations and things that need to be assessed. I think the other thing is, you know, sometimes we have to make sure that we're addressing issues like guardianship. You know, that I don't think should be something that falls onto the adult team. I think that we're following these patients, you know, for a number of years. We know them, we know the families. And so these are things that we, you know, really need to get on top of early. The fifth element, right, and was what we started talking about earlier, is that transfer part. So the transfer of care, again, is a part of transition of care. And this is when we actually go about working with our adult colleagues, having conversations, preparing our checklists, our medical summaries, really engaging, reaching out to them early on, and then confirming that the patients have actually showed up for their appointment, right? So I think until that first interaction has really happened, it's important to recognize that the pediatric team is still responsible for the care of that patient. And then even after the transfer happens, we can still act as consultants. Like I said, I don't know how many adult patients may be familiar with things like biliary atresia, right? Which feels like second nature to us sometimes. But so we, you know, we can really talk about that. Is this inherited? Is this something they can pass down to their children? Yes or no, right? We can answer that very easily. And so I think it's important the pediatric team remain involved in their care. And then, you know, finally, the sixth element is really that transfer completion and then the ongoing care with the adult team. So, you know, figuring out how to continue this transition process, continuing these transition readiness assessments, and then most importantly, I think, eliciting feedback from the families and the caretakers on the entire process, because there's always ways that we can do better. And what we think works may not be what they're experiencing. So that, you know, is kind of a lengthy explanation for these six core elements, but I think they really are so important and a very helpful way to sort of organize your transition clinics and process and a way to think about these patients.
I think that's a really helpful breakdown of those elements. And I agree, it's one of those things that no doubt took hundreds, if not thousands of hours by a team, a broad team mm-hmm. of experts to put together. But as soon as you lay it out, it all seems so intuitive and it makes sense that all of that would need to be there. And I'll just really emphasize that gottransition.org. It is a fantastic website. I remember going through it when reviewing literature around transition in IBD and the CF population that I look after. And it is a fantastic resource. There's a lot of great tools. We'll include a link to the website in our show notes.
And I kind of want to expand upon that a little bit, because the gottransition.org website is really general, and I love that about it. But can you highlight in this table some specifics that might apply to the transplant population that may be different than, say, the IBD population or CF population that Jason previously mentioned?
Yeah, so I think, you know, a couple of the differences, right, are really, if we start from the beginning, right? Just the creating the policy or talking about, you know, some of the early ways we educate our patients, they need to have a continuity with a transplant center. So that may be the same, you know, with the CF, but it does make sometimes finding an adult team a little bit more challenging. These don't exist at every academic center. And so that's one thing we have to sort of consider. With few exceptions, you know, most of our transplant patients are on lifelong medications. And so I think working on medication adherence, finding ways to simplify their regimens are something that we have to think about. Having them understand why they underwent a liver transplant in the first place. Is this something, you know, as they get older and they might be thinking about starting a family and having children, can they pass this on to their offspring? It sometimes maybe seems so intuitive to us, and I'm sure that we talk with their parents very early on. But we sometimes forget that we have to go through and we have to educate the patient, the individual, about some of the things, you know, we've been talking about for years and we almost take for granted with certain families. And I think something else is just, again, I really want to emphasize that this is a process, and it's a process which begins in pediatrics, but really, really needs to be continued by our adult colleagues. So really, I think even educating some of the adult programs on this need is something that we've really tried to get across in this paper. And the partnership is so, so important. I think there is a line in the paper and that one of the authors sort of brought up and I really love, that transfer of care is not just a transfer of records, but a transfer of trust. And I think that really kind of summarizes things very nicely, that if patients and families are seeing, you know, that there's this relationship between some of their pediatric providers and the new adult providers, right, it just offers an extra level of comfort and it makes that transition, that transfer, a little less seamless.
Yeah. And Jason and I were kind of chatting about how it's more than just a passive recipient of our patient, right? There's really that active communication and that parallel care that happens for a short period of time that I think is so important. And of course, here I am just adding ad hoc questions again, but in my world in informatics, you know, there's a lot of EMR tools that really change during this time period as well. Is that part of your particular program as far as teaching children how to access their patient portals, how to ask questions, ask for refills, things like that as well? Because I think, if I remember correctly, gut transition really came out before there was a lot of these tools. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. So I think, you make up a great point, right? So in the past, I think, you know, our institution had migrated to Epic just a few years back. And so before that, the EHR that we were working with was maybe not as sophisticated, so to speak. And so we used to rely on things like, I know SickKids has something called like the patient passport, where we would actually go through, and sometimes there is an advantage to going through and entering information, you know, on their website with the patient. What are your allergies? What are your medications? You click like save, hit send, print out, you know, like a paper copy for them of like a quick, like, hey, if you end up in the ED, like, here's what you can do. You just, you know, show them this. Nowadays, I think that we really encourage everyone to sign up for, you know, an Epic. I know it's called MyChart, but the patient portal. And so again, they can get a quick reference to their medications, right? So always tell them there's no reason that you have to memorize these names. I know it can be very confusing. And, you know, of course, on top of that, every medication has, you know, at least two names, right? Even between the generic and the trade name. And we maybe go back and forth and use those interchangeably. But I think you bring up a great point that it's easily accessible. There's no need to memorize these. You just need to know how to access the information. The other thing that we've been doing is a lot of these transition readiness assessments, you know, we used to use paper and pencil, right? So go through, fill it out with them, and maybe later on we'd enter that into Excel or REDCap. Now we build these surveys like into our EHR, so they're easily imported into different flow sheets. It allows us to track the progress of these patients a lot easier. So that's, I think it's such an important point.
And so we're working our way through this paper. And for people that haven't read it, definitely check out Table 2. It really helpfully breaks down each of those six core elements of transition. And like Jen Lee was alluding to, the really highlighting the sort of parallel involvement of the pediatric and adult teams in each of the elements. So not just like Jen was saying, you know, as a passive recipient of records, and then, oh yes, the patient came with the records, but that they're sort of actively aware of and involved in each of the six elements along the way. And I think that's really important. Right after that, there's figure two, and figure two is also really nice in that it walks through representative stages of transition, including specific steps to take at each stage. And so I was wondering if you could walk us through what early, middle, and late transition should look like, especially within the transplant population.
Yeah, so I think that's such an important point. And like I keep emphasizing, I think that transition should begin as early as possible. So this early adolescence, or, you know, maybe around the age of 12 or 14 is when we should start initiating things. And it doesn't have to take place in the setting of a formal transition program or visit. It's something that we can do very easily in the office. And often that starts with just engaging the patient. I think rather than sitting there and, you know, making eye contact and directing all of our line of questioning to the caretaker, I start to shift my position. I look at the child, I suppose, and ask them to put down the cell phone. And I just start asking them some questions, you know, and it's been really kind of entertaining in some instances, because usually the first question I ask them is, why are you here? you know, why is it that you come and see me? And a lot of them, to their credit, they can answer, well, you know, I had a transplant and you're my liver doctor and whatnot. Other times I get blank stares, you know, and I'll ask them, okay, well, just tell me, what kind of doctor am I? And they'll say, well, you're a regular doctor. And it's, you know, when you think about the transplant population, you know, that's sometimes was surprising to me because here are patients that have an incision, a scar that you would think at some point in time they've questioned or they've noticed is not something that many of their peers walk around with either. So I think just really kind of making sure that they understand that they've had a liver transplant. What is a liver transplant, right? What was the reason that they had their transplant? That's a place to start. You know, next I move on to medications. I mean, we all have to do our med rec anyway. Why not find out from the patient what they know? And I'm not looking for the 12-year-old to tell me, you know, I take 0.1 of blah, blah, blah. Just tell me the name of the medicine. And then we sort of talk about, well, what is that for? Right. And they'll say it's my liver medicine. And sometimes that's good enough for me. Maybe as they get a little bit older and we start to move into middle adolescence, maybe we expand upon that. This is a anti-rejection medicine. And we talk about things. Well, what, tell me what happens if you don't take this medicine? What are some of the possibilities, some of the consequences? And once they've got that foundation, then we start to move along in like this developmentally appropriate fashion. And then it becomes more about in middle or late adolescence, self-management tasks. So rather than mom or dad maybe sitting there in the morning and putting your pill bottle in front of you, maybe you're the one that takes ownership of that. And they can offer gentle reminders, right? We all forget we're only human. Maybe, you know, when it comes time for appointments, we try to get them into the habit of calling the office and scheduling those appointments themselves. Nowadays, even with the EHR, sometimes I just do it online. So it doesn't even mean picking up a phone and having to talk to another human. We can just do this automatically. So I often have them, you know, and most patients have a cell phone nowadays, so they take out their cell phone and I have them put in the phone number for our office together. And we talk a little bit about how you can call that number anytime, day or night, and you will always reach someone from our team. Don't call in the middle of the night because you ran out of medicine, right? But if you're not feeling well and you need to know what to do, that's an appropriate use of this service. So we do a little bit of that education. And then, you know, as they get a little bit closer to that time of transfer, we've got to talk about things like insurance. Do you know who your insurance provider is? Do you know at what age your insurance coverage will stop? If there are any concerns, how do we go about sort of figuring that out now? The last thing I want to do is have you establish care with a new team and then suddenly you don't have insurance coverage. So a lot of things like that, I think really, you know, once you've kind of got the foundation, then you build upon that. And we make sure that each point in time, we're sort of setting new goals. Okay, great. You've learned your medicines. You know the doses. You know where to access them on your phone. Now let's get you comfortable with reaching out to the team with questions. And we'll talk about how to, you know, maybe that's through the portal and mom and dad can still access that. Maybe it's, you know, a phone call to the office. But you want them to really have that experience and feel comfortable with the folks that they know before they start performing those interactions for the first time with a new team.
Yeah. One tack on question, if you don't mind, you know, that comes to mind as a specific for a transplant population, a hepatology population, is in that adolescent time frame. It really puts a little more emphasis on some of those conversations around learning how to manage substances, alcohol, you know, STD or STI awareness and protection and things like that, things that could have a really significant impact on their graft, on the future path of their health. How do you navigate that with the often very involved family that has been with them since their transplant at a year of life or what have you?
Yeah, so I think that's an important point. And we have to have very real conversations. And, you know, certainly I think all of us, again, having trained in pediatrics, we know that you need to allow for one-on-one time, right? So at some point, you need to ask the caretaker to step out of the room. And then you need to have an honest conversation about, you know, some of these risks that we can't pretend that they're not out there. They're not going to encounter a lot of these things. We have many patients that are going off to college and are asking about alcohol. You know, now I don't condone in the U.S. like drinking before the age of 21, but certainly to think that you're never going to have a drink in your entire life is just not realistic. And so we have to talk to them about binge drinking and what are safe practices. I think when we look at some of the transition readiness assessments, The reason why I like those is because they do often include questions about some of these things. So as uncomfortable as it may be for certain providers, I know that one area that I think is very important to bring up is reproduction. And so I usually ask the question every time I'm doing these is, do you know if having had a liver transplant, if you can become or if you can get someone pregnant? And I will tell you the answers that I've gotten are shocking. And I have heard from more than one patient that the answer is no, because I'm on tacrolimus. And I don't know who started this rumor or what blog that is listed on, but we have to go through, you know, wow, and explain that that is not true. And I will say that we've had a handful of patients that found out that was not true, you know, the hard way. And so I think it's really important to bring these things up so early. So, you know, you make a great point. I think sometimes parents need to be educated about this, but certainly the individual has to understand that whatever information they may have gotten this from as, you know, tacrolimus being the same as birth control, it is not.
Yeah, I'll just share. Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No.
just share one anecdote from clinic. I still vividly remember I was seeing a patient with cystic fibrosis, and here are our processes. Children need to transition at 18. That's an institutional age limit. And this was the last visit I was having with her. And this was a really, really with it teenager. She's, looking forward to going to university in the fall and turning 18. And that in my province is actually the drinking age. And she's on a CFTR modulator where alcohol is discouraged, strongly discouraged. And this girl was super appropriate. And she said, you know, I know I'm not supposed to drink on my 18th birthday. What about edibles? And just the she had the wherewithal to know about the risks to her in drinking, was thinking ahead, knowing that she was likely going to want to do something fun with her friends, considering her options. Mm-hmm. And I just remember saying, you know, good for you. Like, you know, I was so impressed with the maturity to just sort of explore it in advance. Think about, what am I going to want to do? Is this safe? Let me get more information. And I thought that was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. I just want to throw out there, like, I love taking care of the adolescent patient population in general, and I'm not a transplant hepatologist, but they often will surprise you with things like that. And it's just makes you feel good about society and humans in general. just throwing that out there. I'm feeling sentimental today. So, you know, O Canada and your 18-year-old limit for transition to adults. I know we've talked about that before on the IBD transition discussion. One of the things I noticed in the figure, Jen, is how these transition stages really give a variable time frame. So it's kind of like an individualized approach. And you already mentioned assessment of transition readiness. So a lot of hospital systems in the U.S. are not quite like what Jason described, that where when you turn 18, no matter what, you go. Can you talk through that transition readiness? And what do you do if you find somebody who's really having a hard time getting to that point?
Absolutely. So I think, again, one thing I would absolutely encourage incorporating into your practice, your transition program, is use of these tools. I, you know, usually start with them at the time of like enrollment into our healthcare transition program, and then I complete them at some sort of routine interval. For me, it's usually at least annually. I don't find that they change if you administer them more frequently than that. But I think, again, going back to this GOT transition website, you'll find that there are a number of validated transition tools that they list there. You know, some people may be familiar with like the TRAC or the Transition Readiness Assessment Questionnaire, the UNC STAR-X, GOT transition, you know, readiness assessment for youth is also there. It doesn't necessarily matter which one you're using. None have been validated in the liver transplant or chronic liver disease population, but they have in kids with underlying chronic illness across the spectrum. And so I think they are extremely reliable. The one that I like to utilize is something called the UNC Transition Index. So this was started by an individual named Maria Ferris at UNC, who is a nephrologist. And the reason that I really like this tool is because it breaks down the transition questions into 10 different domains that I think really like kind of highlight upon the importance of the different components of transition readiness. It has been validated in ages 12 and up. It's available in both English and Spanish, which I think is very important. And it takes about 8 or 10 minutes to sort of complete. But it goes through and it's a, you know, so the mnemonic is transition. And each of those letters stands for a different component. So the first one, T, is like the type of chronic health condition, which we've sort of talked about. You know, why did you have your liver transplants, right? The second one is R, or, you know, medications, you know, tell me your medicines, what time should you be taking them, what happens if you don't take them, adherence, nutrition. I will say it's kind of funny. I have kids that don't know that they're coming to see me because they had a liver transplant, but for some reason, they all seem to know that they can't have grapefruit or pomegranate juice because of the interactions with tacrolimus. I don't know why. They all seem to know that. They may not necessarily be able to sort of verbalize to me why that is, but they almost believe that it's an allergy of theirs. You know, it goes through self-management skills, issues of reproduction, like I was mentioning, you know, trade school, insurance, finding new providers, and so on and so forth. And so I think, Jen, what, you know, we're going to talk about, it's nice because, one, this tool allows you to get an overall sort of transition score. And so I think, you know, maybe the cutoff is something like you have adequate transition readiness if you're 70 or above. But at the same time, it breaks it down and you get scored on each of these 10 different domains. And so why I think that's really helpful is you can look to see where patients are struggling. So if it's in adherence, for instance, right, like they may understand what their disease is, they may know the medicines they're supposed to take, but if they're just not doing it, it allows you to really focus there and see what are some of those barriers. What is it about the adherence component? Are they just forgetful or is it something more? And I think, you know, one of the things maybe we have yet to really touch upon is that the multidisciplinary component of transition of care. And I think especially the mental health aspect, you know, I talked earlier about mental illness and substance abuse leading to a lot of demise in some of these patients. And so I think really digging deeper into those components, if you're depressed, or a lot of times it rolls into self-esteem, my peers aren't taking medicines, why am I taking medicines? You're suffering from PTSD. Well, medications might be a reminder of your transplant. And so perhaps you're exhibiting some avoidance behaviors because of that. So I think this is really a way to sort of identify the barriers here and get patients linked to the appropriate support. For instance, pharmacists sometimes are able to say, you know, they're like, I can't take medicines twice a day. I just can't do it. You know, after school, I'm busy, I'm at work or whatever. Maybe there's ways, you know, where we've been using a lot more of a long-acting tacrolimus rather than BID dosing to try and work with them, right? You're telling me it's a challenge to take your nighttime dose. All right, let's figure out the solution. So I think that, you know, kind of just going through the motions, looking closer at the different components and realizing the aspects that they're struggling with, I think that's really one of the advantages to doing these routine assessments.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful in being able to sort of go through almost like a diagnostic algorithm. I mean, one, it's a check-in, but I think that's really helpful to think about it as a way to zero in on where are the big gains that could be made in terms of that transition readiness, like where are the real sticking points and where to really focus your efforts. And it also transitions, see what I did there? It also transitions really well with my next question around, you know, you spend a lot of the paper talking about the transition process, and we've been talking mostly about the transition process, but you've also sort of slipped in mentions about people that are on your transition team. And the personnel that are on the team are obviously really key to making this all work. That's a very involved process. It's time and resource intensive, as you said. And there are a lot of people that fill very specific roles. So can you talk a little bit about who should be on their team and what are their roles within the transplant transition process?
I think, Jason, that's such an important point, because one of the things we really tried to highlight in this paper was that the key to a successful transition program is this multidisciplinary approach. So I think in an ideal world, the team should include, you know, hepatologists, advanced practice providers, surgeons, pharmacists, nutritionists, social workers, nurses, coordinators, psychologists, psychiatrists from both the pediatric and the adult teams. You know, we've talked extensively at our own program about also including neuropsychologists and financial coordinators, right? But I think the composition of each individual program is really going to depend on the availability of like local personnel and institutional support. You know, above all else, I think that you really need to make sure you have a mental health care provider embedded in this population. We've talked, you know, already a little bit about pediatric transplant recipients and adolescents have higher levels of emotional difficulties. I know that in the last several years, we've been screening all of our patients for anxiety and depression. And what we're finding is that nearly 50% of the patients that are going through our transition clinic are screening positive, right? Now, I can perform those screening tools, right? But I am in no way qualified to do the aftercare. And so this is where it becomes really important to have someone embedded within your team that is not only capable of managing those problems, but also understands what it's like to have a chronic illness, right? So not just to be, you know, a regular old teenager, so to speak, but to understand the implications of having had a transplant. Again, there's so much of this that can be tied into not only their mental health, but maybe is related to or can impact medication adherence. Social workers can also be a critical part of this. Social workers are also instrumental for addressing many of the socioeconomic determinants of health. If you don't have, you know, reliable housing, transportation, or experiencing like food insecurities, your transplant health is not going to be your top priority. And social workers are just so much more in tune and are aware of the local resources that are available to these patients in ways that, you know, I can never pretend to be. I touched upon pharmacists. I will say I have worked with an outstanding group of pharmacists that just seem to have a knack for transition of care. You know, they enjoy interacting with this patient group. They're great at helping us to figure out ways to facilitate medication adherence, coming up, you know, with different sort of tools, going back to the informatics or maybe electronic component. There are things out there that patients can download on their phone, like Transplant Hero, I know is a big one, where you can sort of put in the different medications, the doses, you can set alerts for when you're supposed to be taking those things. And it even provides you with a little bit of education about what they're for. So we, you know, encourage when appropriate to have our patients, you know, utilize those sort of things. If you have the ability to have a transplant coordinator, I would say that that's also huge, because a lot of what we're doing is not just that one sort of transition or clinic visit, but a lot of it is the follow-up after that. So, you know, hey, we talked about you working on identifying when you need to refill your medications and then contacting your pharmacy. How's that going? Have you done that yet? If not, why? How can we help? How can we assist, right? So keeping track of some of the goals that we're setting, when their next appointments are due for. And then again, I think encouraging the participation of our adult colleagues, you know, early on in that process, when it's possible, is also invaluable.
So speaking of like our adult colleagues, I want to expand upon that a little bit, because I was really struck by that. And I've heard of different strategies. So there might be go see an adult colleague, come back to me, see how it went, and have that back and forth. There may be a co-appointment, especially with telemedicine. Can you talk a little bit about what that transfer actually looks like and why it's so important?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think Jason was touching upon this a little bit earlier, but you know, one of the unfortunate realities is that the decision on when to transfer a patient from pediatrics to adult healthcare is often not up to the patient or even their healthcare providers, right? But it's often dictated by the system. So Jason mentioned that in Canada, the transfer of care age occurs at age 18. And my understanding is that there's very little flexibility surrounding that age. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it varies a little bit by institution or province, but by and large, you know, it's a big ordeal to ask for special permission to extend your supervision of a patient for a long period of time beyond 18.
Right. So, I mean, ready or not, these patients, you know, have to leave the comfort of pediatrics and they have to somehow find a way to continue the support throughout this transition spectrum. And so I think sometimes, you know, it's helpful to engage our adult colleagues early. So again, like Jen was alluding to, it really depends on what the makeup at your individual institution is. I've been fortunate that I've worked at places where we have an affiliated adult transplant center. And so what we've done in those is to have, you know, either the adult provider, and usually we try and identify someone that, you know, wants to take care of this particular patient population that has the familiarity and the experience and, you know, and is very engaged. So it's like a good match for all. We've had it where, you know, again, even if the child is 12 years old, if we have our transition program going on that day, our adult providers will stop by and go in and say hello, right? And even if it's just to, gosh, even if it's just to talk about music interests and Beyonce or the Taylor Swift tickets right now, you know, just to kind of engage them in some way. And if we're working with these folks for a few years, at least they're getting to see that face and hear that name for some time. So it's not as much of a shock. We've also had instances where, you know, for our patients who are 18 and older, we've actually held our transition clinic in our adult space. So they're coming in, they're checking in at the adult center. The walls are not as colorful. There are some different ages sitting in the waiting room, but they're coming into the room and they're seeing me. So at least there's some bit of familiarity there. In some instances, there may not be that affiliation. And so the opportunities to do a meet and greet, so to speak, right, may be a little bit more limited. And I think, Jen, you bring up a great point with utilizing like telehealth, right? So we've done that too, where we've all sort of gotten on the screen together. You know, we've asked the questions, we've talked about concerns, and we do follow-ups with the patients and families. I think liver transplant sometimes, you know, it's almost a blessing and a curse, but for the most part, our patients do very well, right? That is the blessing. The curse is that we don't always see them that frequently. Maybe we're seeing them twice a year. Whereas, you know, I've talked to some of my colleagues in hematology who are following a group of sickle cell patients, and what they like to do is they'll alternate visits with the adult team and the pediatric team and so on and so forth. But they're seeing these patients so often that it's not an extra visit for the patients. They're coming in anyway. They're just kind of alternating where they're seeing their care. You know, so I think it's really, you've got to kind of play around with it a little bit to see what works for your individual program. You know, you may have different centers where the majority of your patients are transferring their care, or maybe not. You know, sometimes we may get patients, for instance, in New York, right? Sometimes New Jersey is not that far away, but, you know, once they turn 18, 21, insurances give us a little bit of pushback by coming to a New York center and they say, hey, you have to find a provider. There are adult transplant teams here in New Jersey now. So we're no longer going to allow this sort of back and forth. So there are a lot of things, and this is why I think early planning is so important, because there are a lot of these types of issues that come up that we really need to address and come up with a safe transfer plan that works for everyone. I think in terms of our feedback from some of my adult colleagues, I think they do sometimes find this helpful to get to know the patients. You know, we have monthly meetings where we're talking about different medical or psychosocial concerns. So they at least get to hear about some of these things before they assume care of the patients. And they know that we're still available for consultation. So if there's something going on or they're struggling with the families, you know, we can re-engage. We don't encourage taking them back to our praxis. You know, it sort of seems like going backwards a little bit. And a lot of times the institution won't allow us to do that. But I think it's been helpful in terms of having them see kind of the difference in approach, this more holistic approach that we've adopted in pediatrics. I think at least for some time during young adulthood, may make the most sense for this population. And I think also in the paper, tables 3 and 4, you know, I think we kind of created purposely to help guide some of our adult colleagues in terms of topics to include, or even there's like a great, you know, transfer sort of checklist that they can go through with the patients to see where they're at.
That's great. And, you know, so throughout our conversation today, we've talked a lot about what transition is. We've talked about the elements of transition, the sort of stages of transition, who's on the team. The last element that we really wanted to touch on is outcome measures, because Jen Vittorio, you started us off with a discussion about how you really built this passion for this topic, and that striking figure of 30% of transplant patients passing away, you know, sometime after transition. That's a pretty hard outcome to swallow. But if we are going to try and change what that looks like, obviously we need to really care about what are the outcomes that come as a result of all this work that you're putting into a more established transition process. So could you talk a little bit more about, you know, what are the specific outcomes that we should be tracking, that we should be looking at in order to understand the impact of our transition programs? And are there differences between the patients that, you know, had their transplant as infants or early in life versus the adolescents that you've only been following maybe for a shorter period of time?
Yeah, so I think this was something that our group really spent a lot of time discussing, because I think, you know, there's no, due to the lack of a standardized approach to healthcare transition, it's really hard to identify what are those successful outcome measures. What is it that we should be measuring success upon? And I think we have to go beyond like your patient and graft survival. Certainly those are important, but I think other measures like adherence, healthcare costs, and most importantly, probably quality of life, you know, really have to come into the play too, because I think the goal is that what we want for our patients is not just survival, but really improved quality of life and sustained well-being, right? So we're performing liver transplant because we believe that it's really going to positively impact the life that this person is going to lead. And 1 year survival, 5 year survival, you know, even 20 year survival, right? We're now just coming upon young adulthood in many instances, and they have so much more of their life to go. So I think what we tried to go through is really think about what are the things that we believe are important, not only to providers, but to patients as well. So certainly, you know, medical outcomes are important, and we have objective metrics like LFTs and liver histology and elastography, which looks at liver health. But I think we've also got to look for complications of long-term immunosuppression, like cancer, compromised renal function, cardiovascular health, right, are all things that we need to be assessing for. And we may not see until they're transferring over into the adult practice, right? I think healthcare providers, we do a terrible job of assessing patient adherence, right? But luckily, there are things like variations in immunosuppressant drug levels that we can look at, or the MLVI, which is the Medication Level Variability Index, which hasn't been a validated measure of adherence. We can track whether or not they're showing up to their office visits, whether or not they're getting their labs done as instructed. So those are all things that we can keep an eye on. But I think this idea of, or concept of, health-related quality of life is vastly important. And that's going to look at things like the physical, mental, emotional, social, and functional status of a patient. So we mentioned earlier that these patients are often struggling with, you know, depression, anxiety, suicide, substance abuse. And when we add on a chronic illness, you know, like liver transplant, I think that their health-related quality of life really decreases. And this is going to, you know, affect adherence. It's going to lead to sleep disturbances, poor school functioning, right? So these are things that we need to be tracking. There are validated health-related quality of life measures. You know, I know that Vicky Ng has done a great job of designing something called the PedsQL transplant module, which is, I think, available for patients under the age of 18, and tries to help tease out who are the patients that are really suffering here. I think some of the differences between those kids that get transplanted in infancy versus, you know, adolescence, it really depends on the amount of time that we have with them, right, to work on some of these processes. It's really tough when you meet an individual for the first time, you know, presents an acute liver failure at the age of 17 or 18, they undergo a transplant, and now they're at that sort of tricky, where do they go? Do they stay in pediatrics? Do they go to the adult side? And you haven't had the luxury of knowing them ahead, or spent, you know, like getting to know them through their entire life. It's just a small snapshot. And so I think those are some things that really can be a struggle. Versus if you're meeting the patients, you know their family members so well, and you've sort of developed this longstanding relationship. But I think here we really wanted to highlight, you know, again, yes, the medical part is important, but what would a patient want for themselves? High school graduation, the ability to hold a job, right? To pay their rent, things like this. These are our goals for anyone. And I think that we have to extend those and look to see if all of the efforts that we're putting into for transition, are they making a difference? I suspect that they are, but I think this is really something that's also lacking in the literature. And is probably, you know, as more and more pediatric centers are adopting programs, and as our adult colleagues really work to continue those efforts, I think this is data that we need to really capture and to see, because I suspect there are definitely areas where we can be doing better. And maybe, you know, maybe we got it wrong. Maybe there are other outcomes that we should be examining. And so those are things that I really look forward to seeing, you know, how that comes about and develops in the coming years.
I love that. I think transitioning or transitioning, see, now I'm doing it, Jason. But flipping that narrative to it's now the actual survival piece is not as rare anymore compared to 40 years ago, right? Now the expectation is that, hey, these children are going to survive. How can we have meaningful lives? How can they achieve all the goals that they're wanting to do? I think that is such a powerful statement, and I am really looking forward to seeing that as well. So, okay. So this has been a wonderful conversation, Jen. I have really, really enjoyed having this discussion. If you had to look back on your career, what would be the most valuable advice that you have received? And what advice do you have for your listeners?
So it's actually funny that you asked this. So I was giving a grand rounds this week on liver transplantation. And in one of my slides, I kind of have this like timeline of liver transplant. And on there, I've included this quote from Dr. Thomas Starzl, right, who was the first surgeon to perform pediatric liver transplant. And that quote is, a problem might be achievable, but only with great risk to yourself, great risk of failure, and professional disgrace. And even though that might not sound like the most uplifting, I just think about, what if Dr. Starzl gave up? Would we even be sitting here having this conversation, right? So the first liver transplant, that patient did not survive. I don't even think made it out of the operating room. But just a few years later, we achieved our first 1-year survival. And so something that I really want to take from that experience or to pass on is that just have a goal, right? Keep at it. Don't let others discourage you. I think back, you know, I talked a little bit about my med peds background. I remember my med school advisor saying, med peds, no, that's not a field I believe in. It's too much for any one person to learn, you know, and almost discouraging me from pursuing that. I have no regret. I enjoyed my training. I think it's made me the hepatologist that I am today, and that I can draw off of, you know, some of the things I learned in adult medicine, pediatric medicine, and probably is a big part of the reason why I am interested in healthcare transition. So I would say, don't be discouraged. Just go for what you're passionate about.
I think that's really great advice for all of our listeners, particularly our trainees who are trying to figure out where they should go as opposed to maybe where they want to go. And I think that's good advice that they can be one and the same thing. If I could just ask you, you know, reviewing everything that we've talked about so far today about transition, if you have, you know, your top three takeaway points that you want people to leave this episode with about the area of transplant transition, what would they be?
Top three. So I'd say number one would probably be start early, right? So healthcare transition, I think, initiated early by the pediatric team, probably around the age of 12. The second point would be to emphasize the multidisciplinary approach, right? So a successful healthcare transition program, you know, there has to be a structure, it has to be multidisciplinary. And I would really encourage listeners to utilize those six core elements of healthcare transition, because I think they offer a nice guideline. And the third is partnership. So I think, again, successful transition is going to require a partnership between pediatric and adult providers across all disciplines. And again, that this transition process does not end at the time of transfer, but continues throughout early adulthood.
I think those are excellent takeaways and a great summary of what we covered today. Dr. Victorio, thank you again so much for being on Bowel Sounds today.
Thank you so much for having me. I truly appreciate it.
What a great episode, Jason. I think that transition time is such an important and special time for patients, parents, and gastroenterologists alike.
Absolutely. And if you don't already, be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @BowelSounds and on Facebook at Pediatric GI Podcast for the latest news and updates on upcoming episodes. And of course, if you liked what you heard and want to support the podcast, it would really help us out if you did one or more of the following things. First of all, tell someone else about the podcast. To leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It really does help people discover our show. And third, on our Buzzsprout page, there's a link to support the show by making a donation to the NASPGHAN Foundation. And you can also get there through www.naspghan.org. The money you donate can help support some of the amazing things that the NASPGHAN Foundation is doing, which includes supporting that pediatric GI research, public education programs, and more.
And as always, the discussion, views, and recommendations of the podcast are the sole responsibility of the host and guest and are subject to change with advances in the field.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks, everybody. Bye for now.
Bye.